motion for approval of those minutes? Senator Hand moves to approve the minutes. Any corrections or additions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. We now have the next case before us, and Mr. Lindeke, why don't you give us a little introduction of the case, and we'll have testifiers.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, you recall the Baker claim that we discussed at our last meeting. The folks live in Roseville. The Department of Health directed them to dig up a well in their yard and either cap it or get a contract to maintain it. Turned out the well wasn't there. When they did dig into the yard, they found the remains of a greenhouse, the basement of a greenhouse, and in it were a couple of oil tanks that they did have to then remove and deal with. And so the whole thing cost a couple thousand dollars in expenses and was actually a mistaken attempt to find a well that was on someone else's property, as it turned out. It was eventually found and dealt with by the owner of that property. And the department, at the instruction of Representative Osment, we talked with the Department of Health concerning the fund that they had available to pay for this, and they offered $1,000 for the cost of actually digging for the well and then filling it back in, which didn't deal with the cost of getting rid of the oil tanks and some other expenses claimed by the Bakers. The Bakers did not accept the $1,000 from the Department of Health and instead renew their claim with the Claims Subcommittee. And the reason why we're taking it up now out of order is because Representative Greiling is here right now and has other things she needs to go and do in a while. So I think just to indicate that the Bakers are still interested in pursuing this claim, Representative Greiling is here to speak to us.
Representative Greiling, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I very much appreciate your time for this issue as well as all the other ones you're dealing with today. I have never in my 15 years in the legislature been to a meeting of the Claims Committee. So it's worth it, I guess, to have the Department of Health digging in my constituents' yard just to get here. And so thank you very much. There's so many hardworking committees in this legislative body that we don't all know about. But anyway, the Bakers are out of town, and so they asked if I would sit in for them and just make sure that they're treated fairly. And I see very good legislators on this committee, and so I'm confident that will happen. They're a senior couple, and so they're very anxious about this because they just have this sense of justice and fair play, and they just don't think it's right that they end up having to pay for something through their no fault of their own. And I think they, and certainly I too, realize that the Department of Health was, doing their job well as well. So I think it's just an unfortunate circumstance that hopefully your good minds can help put to right. So thank you very much.
Okay. We have questions from committee members. All right. I believe that the information I have is that the department, or you mentioned the department, has offered $1,000?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They've offered $1,000. The Bakers didn't feel that that was adequate because their claim was for $4,000 and some odd. And we have all of the items. I hope you all got an email that I sent at some point with the other items that the Bakers are claiming for, including landscaping, the cost of disposing of the fuel tanks, which once they were dug up, had they not been dug up, they wouldn't have had to do anything with them, but once they were dug up, the city required them to get rid of the fuel tanks. And then, of course, there's the cost, which we don't have, we're not sure of, the value of the birch trees that were dug up And, of course, Mr. Baker's concern that all of this time spent by him is worth $1,000 just because it was an aggravation. So there are a lot of other parts of the claim, and the $1,000 wasn't considered enough.
And, Mr. Chair?
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One more comment that I forgot, that he had a couple of other things that he actually is not claiming for. And one of them is he had to remove a retaining wall because of this, and also his driveway is now sinking as a result of this excavation, which was very close to his driveway. But he did not put in for those claims.
Okay. Could we have someone from the department come up? Last time we visited on this issue, I think we asked for some negotiations to take place, and your result was to offer, I think, $1,000, and could you give us a little background on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, John Stein with the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm the director of the Division of Environmental Health, and we have with me today Dan Wilson, manages the well management section in our division. We did, as instructed, seek to review the invoices and the costs that were relevant to the direction that was given to the Bakers to search for a well and then to cover up the costs relevant to restore that excavation. And that amounted to approximately $1,000, which we offered to the Bakers. And as you've noted, they declined that. Some of the, and I don't, I want to pour over the details of our response, our July 6, 2007 response to the committee to the Baker's claim. However, one of the questions Senator Latz asked last time was, couldn't we have done a better job, I'm paraphrasing, Senator, couldn't we have done a better job of searching for previous owners and knowing more before we put a backhoe on the property and started the excavation.
I can put it more starkly if you wish.
I want to speak into the mic.
No.
I think I could come up with my own alternatives, but I'll choose not to. But that was the essence of your question. Why didn't we search harder to find out more before we put a backhoe out there? And I wanted to just clarify that when we did the initial search of the records on the property, there were no previous property owners to be found. It came as a matter of, some might call it serendipity, that the excavator, the well construction contractor, Mr. Salverda, asked his father, who is also a well driller, if that name of the previous property owner rang any bells, so to speak, as far as previous associations. The Salverdas did have knowledge of previous owners and knew that the family members were still living in Roseville, and found a family member in the area who happens to be a member of my church, happens to be a friend that I went to high school with, as it turns out. And so I find this even more interesting as I dig into this claim, that we then found the family, the Valois or Valois family, who did reside at this property originally, and they were able to tell us that, in fact, that was the location of the old greenhouse, and that as the excavation had continued, that that's what was going to be found there. I do want to just state on the record that once we realized that we were not dealing with a buried well or an abandoned well on the property, we did no longer at that point direct any of the actions that the Bakers took. We turned the matter over to the parties who are responsible for buried tanks and fire hazards, which this is the fire marshal in Roseville, as well as the Department of Commerce and their abandoned tank, fuel tank program. So while I certainly agree that we could have done a more exhaustive search, we did follow the process that we always follow, which is we look at the available records. We ask the most knowledgeable people that we can find in the area, and having not found any of that knowledge, we then use the scientific methods that we typically use, magnetometers and other evidence, to look for underground buried casing, steel pipe, what have you. And that was what caused the extent of the excavation on the Baker's property. I think that's all I'll say for now and answer any additional questions that committee members may have. And Mr. Wilson can also respond to more detailed questions of the history.
Thank you. And I think one of our additional questions had to do with the petrol fund and how the petrol fund may interface with this because it was an abandoned tank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did speak with Mr. Joel Fisher. I don't know if Mr. Fisher's in the room today.
He is.
Thank you. There he is. Thanks. And consulted as to whether the program the Department of Commerce administers would be able to fund the removal of tanks of the type that were found, and Mr. Fisher can explain it if you'd like him to, but basically the answer to that was no, because they were found within the confines of a basement. They were not part of the program as defined by the statute that controls their cost-sharing or funding programs to eliminate buried tanks.
Okay, if we could have testimony from the gentleman also. Yeah, Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, I'll leave it to Mr. Fisher to explain what he explained to us over the telephone.
Fisher, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Joel Fisher. I'm the director of the Petro Fund program at the Department of Commerce.
Okay. Could you explain the situation here?
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The Bakers, I believe a representative of the Bakers, contacted our staff engineer right when the tanks were found. And basically what our engineer told their representative was that they would need to submit an application. As part of the abandoned underground storage tank program, you submit an application, we then review it, and if we determine that it fits all the criteria, we have state contractors that go out and actually do pull the tanks and excavate any contaminated soil that's necessary. In this case, when they called, our contracts we had in place at the time had just ended, and we were in the process of renewing the contracts. So there was no contract in place, but what Mr. Houck, our engineer, had told them was they need to submit an application, we'll take a look at it. And it appeared at first that it probably would be eligible for reimbursement as an underground tank. What we found after we got a little more information is that because they're tanks in a basement and not necessarily underground storage tanks, the application would have come in, we would have indicated to them that it wouldn't fall under this. We've had other questions previously from potential applicants wondering, I have an old fuel oil tank in my basement. Does that fall under the – we haven't used it since prior to 1988, does that fall under the program? And we've indicated that it doesn't actually qualify. It has to be an underground tank. Obviously, this case is a little bit different in that,
it's underground.
Depending on how you look at it, it's an abandoned tank or an abandoned tank that was somewhat buried because the basement had been buried. So it's a little bit different than what we typically see. But our initial indication would have been that we would not be able to cover that, the cost to remove the tank.
How much would have been available if you had been able to, if it was okay or fall within the program, what was available for removal?
What they would have done is they would have, if we would have signed off on the application, we then would have, one of our contractors would have gone out and given us an estimate of what the cost would be. They'd go out and get bids from tank removal contractors, and then whatever that dollar amount, there's no limit, I guess is what I should say, in terms of, so if they came back with a $1,000 bid, we would then do a work order for $1,000, and the contractor would go out and do the work.
What's your experience tell you is the average cost on something like that size tank?
I would say for the work they did, $1,000 is right well within the range. We typically would see under our standard program, right in that range, $1,000.
Representative O'Loughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Mr. Fisher, it's my understanding of the Petro Tank Fund is actually to protect groundwater,
yep,
and to make sure that leaking tanks are not a threat to the environment. And it seems to me that this is actually instance and when it actually should have applied, and I'm just offering some advice as these situations arise in the future. It's not a remodeling of a basement, and I want to get rid of that big old tank that's down there. This was clearly already buried. It was in the ground. It was not being, you know, contained within an active, maintained building, and so I just really would hope that we don't see future claims that are denied based on the fact that there happened to have been a basement around it at one time that is now filled in with dirt, and it wasn't done by the current property owner.
Fisher.
Representative Loeffler, I agree. We would struggle with this question because it is such a strange situation. Howie and my predecessor made the initial decision, and we've kept with it, is to say that we would look at the tank at how it was used when it was in use. And a tank in a basement when it was in use would typically be considered an above-ground tank, which we can't reimburse by statute. I see what you're saying, though. The fact that in this case it's an above-ground tank that ultimately was partially buried, could we look at it differently? Possibly. I would have to talk to our staff attorney to make sure on that.
I can see the quandary it should be in. I was a former fire marshal and assistant fire marshal in Minneapolis, and dealing with underground tanks, if we had it where you had a tank in the basement and people to get some money for removing it, then we're able to fill in the basement first and then become eligible to remove the tank, you end up with a problem. So this was kind of a very unusual situation.
Right.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to get a little clarification. I know that originally this was understood to be a well, and there we have some provisions that require that this well be dealt with. And we also have provisions that if you have underground storage tanks, that they have to be dealt with as well. If it would have been known before any of this started exactly what we were dealing with, would there have been any requirement made by the state for the Bakers to do anything about this issue? If it would have been known it wasn't a well, it would have been known it wasn't an underground tank, would there have been any requirement of the state for the property owners to do something?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, from the Department of Health's perspective, when property is transferred, there's a requirement to report any unknown or any undocumented wells on the property or unused wells on the property. I believe that had there been a conclusive knowledge that there was no well on the property, no, there would not have been excavation required. There was not conclusive knowledge of that fact, to my understanding.
And Mr. Chairman, and
Senator Hand.
I appreciate your, and I understand that, and I'm not trying to say that there should have been knowledge beforehand. What I'm trying to get at, though, is that it seems to me that what we did is that we required, for reasons that we believed to be sound but turned out to not be, a requirement of the property owner to go through some process to remove this. And in the course of doing that, there were costs that were incurred that were more than what your estimates might have been. And I'm just struggling with, given the way this turned out, and if there really was no need for it to be removed in the first place, and yet they did it anyway under the thinking that they had to, I'm not sure why we wouldn't want to just accept their claim and say, if we would have known the true circumstances, we would never would have asked them to do anything. And so they could have continued life as it had been without any loss at all. So I'm kind of struggling with that because I'm thinking there was no harm, and yet we compelled them under the assumption that there might be harm to incur a cost that we ought to perhaps reimburse them for. But
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Fisher.
I just one comment, and then Mr. Fisher as well, Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, that ultimately, though, there was a problem there. I mean, it wasn't as though there was no problem. There was there was an underground tank there. By fiat of definition, there's what it is, but there was an underground source of potential contamination there.
And Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate that, and I would agree intuitively, I'd say it's an underground tank, but we just heard them say it was an underground tank. And so if it is, then it would seem to be subject to some reimbursement on the Petro Fund, but if it's judged it isn't, then I don't know how we can go back and say, well, you have to take it out. If it's not an underground tank, then it's not an underground tank. You don't have to take it out.
Mr. Fisher, maybe you can answer the question as to whether the tank would have been required to be removed once it was discovered, regardless of what we called it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, actually, state law would require, once they've discovered the tank, whether it's an underground tank or an above-ground tank, they have a year to remove it. So They would have had to, the Bakers would have had to removed it within a year of discovery.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamm.
Just to clarify, so if it had been discovered and known to be a storage tank for fuels, even though it was not technically an underground storage tank, we would have required that they remove that. Would there have been funds available then to reimburse them for the cost of that removal given the circumstance? So we would...
No.
You're saying no. We would require them to remove it and excavate to remove it, but we wouldn't say that it was an underground tank even though... okay. Right. I understand.
One thing I should just clarify is if this would have been an underground tank... Let's say just a straightforward underground tank, and they would have called us just as they did and said, we'd like you to come out and remove the tank today or in the next week. We would have given them the same response. My engineer, he would have said, we can't come out right now. We don't have a provision for emergency work. You would have to submit an application, and we would look at it. And if it does fit, let's say it would have a straightforward underground tank, we then would have had to, get a contractor lined up and a work order. It still would have taken a while to do it. So even under the circumstances, if they weren't willing to wait for our program to get caught up with them, we couldn't have paid any of the cost or hired the contractor. Okay. But this does happen all the time, quite a bit, where people are required to remove tanks, whether underground or above ground, and in general they don't, like a gas station, they would not get paid for any of those costs. From the Petra Fund, I should say.
Mr. Wendicke.
Well, Mr. Chair, as the members of the subcommittee will recall, it was important to the Bakers at the time, once they had dug this hole looking for the well, to fill it in. They live in a neighborhood where there are people, children, and they didn't want to leave this hole open while applying for money from the Petra Fund and waiting to see what happened, and then who knows what would happen with this big hole in their yard. This isn't a huge farm or anything. It's a residential dwelling in the city. So I understand that their concern was to get the pipe, to get the oil tanks out of there as quickly as possible and fill in the hole.
Okay, are there other questions? Senator Lance.
Was there a difference in the cost by doing it promptly instead of waiting?
Mr. Fisher, would it make a difference that the hole was already partially open? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I don't believe so. I think that it would have, regardless if they would have done it right away or waited, it would have been about the same price.
Yes. Okay. Other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to, I don't have questions for the witness. I have a question about the claim and how I might resolve this. But so I don't know if you're prepared to move on to that.
I think we're getting pretty close. I just have one question to Mr. Fisher, though, first, and that is the reason that the Petra Fund or this tank was originally thought to be not eligible under the circumstances that we have right now is because it was determined to be a tank in a basement. If this committee decided it was, in fact, an underground tank and eligible, and we had that part of the statutory language, then would there be money within the Petra Fund to contribute at least $1,000 towards that effort?
Mr. Chair, yes, there would be.
So we may divide it. The reason I wanted that to come in was that we may divide it up a little bit. Are there other questions? Representative Loeffler, if you have a suggestion.
Mr. Chairman, the one thing that I had I am sympathetic to the Bakers, and I think that they ended up in a very unfortunate situation, and I would hope that that has made the Department of Health much more diligent in contacting previous owners and really getting the information as best they can, and I know sometimes it's an art, not a science, to find these things. But I do have a question about the budget that they've requested, in that it does include $1,000 for the time and hassle of dealing with this, and I can understand why it's incredibly frustrating to suddenly have your whole yard, dug up, and you're not sure who's going to pay, and the costs keep getting bigger. But in the year that I've been on this committee, I haven't seen us paying for that, and so I'd like to talk about that component. But I am sympathetic to many components of the claim itself.
Well, Representative Loeffler, just my comment would be I concur in that we don't pay for pain and suffering in other situations either, and that was really what I heard being described. as well as the overall work that is all of us may have a different opinion as to how much we're worth when we get involved with this. So we haven't really done that in the past either, to my knowledge. And Mr. Lindeke, if I'm inaccurate, would you correct me,
please? Well, Mr. Chair, the only instance I can remember is one that would back up what you just said. We had a claim for damage to a cabin by a prisoner who had how he'd gotten out, I guess, or something. In any event, it was a claim against the Department of Corrections, and among the things that had been stolen, there were a lot of things broken in the person's cabin, but his liquor was stolen. And he wanted us to pay, the owner of the cabin wanted us to pay him at his hourly rate for the time that he spent going to the liquor store to resupply his liquor cabinet. And no, the subcommittee did not pay that amount.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
Given the comments that have been made here, what would be then the actual cost of, if we say, well, there was $1,000 that was put into this claim that was for annoyance, and if there were some other, if we deduct those things, what would be the total amount of the claim then? I'm trying to look at the documentation. It's not becoming clear to me. Do we know what that would be if you took those elements out of it?
The amount of the claim is $4,918, and if we took the $1,000 off that they're asking for the their years of grief, that would reduce it down to $3,918. And then we are I was looking at the there's also two claims here for the value of the trees, and knowing that once you have discovered a an underground tank, you're going to have to remove the underground tank regardless of the situation it's in, and so those trees would have had to have been removed in that process anyway. Mr. Fisher, are trees when people remove underground tanks, does the petrol fund reimburse them for the trees that have to be taken out in order to get to the tank?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, we would cover any costs that we would need to if we need to remove trees or shrubs or anything to access the tanks.
I didn't phrase it correctly. Is there a scheduled value then for a tree?
No.
What I heard you say is you'd pay for the cost of removing the tree, would you reimburse them for the perceived value of the tree?
No, we would only we would only pay for the cost to actually remove the tree, and then we take it back up to the point where it's bare ground again, and we don't cover any of the costs to, if it's asphalt, we wouldn't cover the cost to re-asphalt it, or we leave that part to the applicant.
So the claims for black dirt and seed and fertilizer and things like that, you wouldn't cover that cost either?
No.
Okay. Members, I'd maybe, unless somebody's ready to make a motion, I would suggest that maybe we want to set this aside a little bit so we can kind of maybe get a chance to review these numbers and maybe come back with a proposal or that would make some sense, if that was all right. Would that be okay? Is there anything additional that we should know before we set this aside? Okay, we'll set the Baker claim aside for the time being, and we may get back to it yet later today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Gremley. I think we are probably ready to revert back to our earlier business we had this morning. Senator Latz is not allowed to leave when we do that.
I was looking for a Senate counsel. I don't see them in the room. So.
Oh, okay. They probably are listening and on their way, it would be my guess.
Wherever you are, Senate counsel, come back.
We to bring people up to speed as to when we had the earlier this morning, we took a recess for us to kind of discuss some options with how to deal with the proposal that Senator Latz and the governor's administration presented this morning. And can you give us an update, Senator Latz, as to where we're at?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, we were touching base with a few people on the proposal. One reason I was looking for Senate counsel was to see if he's concluded his part of the touching base process. So I don't see him now, but why don't I just say what we were thinking in terms of a...
Before you do that, Senator Latz, because of that, and I know you need that information, do you want me to just continue this, that for a while? We just revert back to some of the other business?
Yeah, maybe we'll do that, and we'll see if we can track both down.
We don't want to piecemeal it too much.
Way. Okay. No, that's fine. Go on to the next claim, then. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Lindeke, what would you suggest be our next claim that we would take a look at?
Well, Mr. Chair, the McEachrans and Representative Atkins are not here yet,
no.
So we should move on to the probably the best thing to do would be to go to Mr. Sandman Shelifo's claim for his medicine bag since he is here.
Okay.
And listen to him first and whoever his guests are.
All right. And, Mr. Lindeke, if you give us a little update, a mind refresher on that case.
Mr. Chair, while he was being, I think, while he was going into incarceration, he had a, Mr. Sandman Shelifo had a medicine bag, and apparently it was not sewn shut. So the department acknowledges they made rather a mistake by handing it to someone who eventually lost it in his stolen car, and no one's ever seen it again. It was intended that it be sewn shut, but now it's disappeared, and Mr. Sandman Shelifo, it's a very valuable item, I'm sure will tell us a little bit more about the situation.
Mr. Sandman Shelifo? Welcome to the committee, and if you identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Minno Gijic Sandman Shelifo.
Hey.
Hello, committee.
And we you have a claim before us, and if you could give us maybe a... we know that the your claim, you refused one of the offers of the department. And
yes, sir. I refused it because I think that was insignificant and like an insult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean... You can't put a value on my religion, you know what I mean?
Were you contacted recently by the department or others to inform you as to what they may have discovered
I've been calling Alan Walls, and all I get is an answer machine. I've been calling Chaplain Schaefer, same thing. Yeah, his supervisor, Mary Atkins, same thing. No.
So you do not know what happened to the medicine bag at this point, or have you been informed?
The last I heard, they gave it to this guy named Greg Davis.
Yes.
Greg Davis has been not returning phone calls. He hasn't been returning letters. And, you know, I really don't know what's going on with it. I even asked them if I could have Mr. Davis's address myself or phone number so I could go speak to him myself about this.
And that was not
They said they could not give it to me because they think whatever.
And do I call you Mr. Shelifo or Sandman Shelifo?
Well, you can call me Mr. Sandman.
So Mr. Sandman, all right. Mr. Sandman, when your claim came before us, we read through the claim that you submitted in detail. From that information, we were able to make some contact, eventually with Mr. Davis. And if Mr. Lindeke could give us an update as to what happened in that conversation.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, and Mr. Sandman, interestingly enough, after people had told me so many times that Mr. Davis would not answer their calls, I got his phone number from Representative Osmond. I called him. He answered on approximately the first ring, and I had a wonderful conversation with Mr. Davis concerning your medicine bag. He's very apologetic about its loss. He parked his car. I think he has a Chevy Cavalier or something, whatever it was. He parked his car outside his place. It had this box of items, including your medicine bag. Somebody stole it. They found it in Hinckley, I believe.
The car.
The car, but not any of your stuff. And he talked later with a couple of kids that he assumed were the ones who stole his car. And they apparently admitted that they had. And they said, oh, yeah, we left that out in the woods. And they didn't say which woods, and they don't know which woods, they claim. So the stuff is gone, as far as Mr. Davis is concerned, and it was gone as part of the theft of his car. So apparently we will never see, unless someone stumbles across it, your medicine bag again. That's what Mr. Davis told me.
The leads us to a very difficult situation because I believe there's any way that this committee will be able to compensate you for what the value of that bag is to you. And I would really like to suggest that, which I would have, I didn't know that you were, we were able to contact you. I know that I'd asked staff and others to try, and I didn't know that had been accomplished.
Yeah, I just got contacted 2 days ago by
Mr. Hartnett.
Yeah.
Okay. And what I'd like to do is see if we can't get you and Mr. Davis in contact with one another, and then maybe you can find out some things from him that possibly, because I, according to all your communication, you're really interested in trying to recover that bag.
Yes, I am.
And so trying to see if that can be our outcome is finding that bag. I would like the department to get all the information that we've already provided, or Mr. Lindeke can provide to you on how to reach Mr. Davis. He's with the Mille Lacs Ojibwe. He's a youth director up there with the, with their programs, and I think that this is something that maybe the entire tribe up there would be interested in learning about and maybe trying to help. Because it may be some interpersonal relationships may help people actually find that bag. I don't know that, but I would like to give that a try. Would you be interested in doing that? Because before we actually decide a claim, and we can try to come back to that point if necessary at a later date, the difficulty is our ability to compensate you for that claim is going to be very, very limited. And so it's really interested more in trying to help you find the bag. Mr. Lindeke.
Well, Mr. Chair, let me just ask Mr. Sandman, what tribe or band are you a member of?
I am from Keweenaw Bay, Michigan.
Oh. Did you come down here from Michigan for this?
I came from a very pretty far place, yes.
Wow. Where is that?
Well, from where I come from, that same amount of miles as if I drove from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to Detroit would be the same amount of miles it came from.
It's a long way. I've been there. Wow. So, Mr. Sandman, the issue, of course, is attempting to communicate with Mr. Davis, but who knows what the good result of that. And then, finally, determining what value, the department would like to pay you only $75. I know that because that's their limit on religious items. And the subcommittee may come up with a higher number. We won't know exactly how to come up with that higher number, but it's probably not going to be $1 million.
I put it up there because I'm trying to show the seriousness.
I understand
that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we'll then have to put some value on it, but just to let you know, the subcommittee doesn't actually have any money. The subcommittee has to draft a bill, introduce it in both houses of the legislature. It has to be passed by the legislature and signed by the governor in order to have money to pay a claim, and that money is likely not available until July 1st of 2008. So we wanted to have you here to find out more about the value of the medicine bag because we may eventually have to deal with putting a value on it. And $1 million cannot be the answer. It's not worth $1 million. Its sentimental value may be that, but we probably won't be able to pay you that for it. Is there any way of knowing how valuable a medicine bag actually is in dollar terms?
There is no dollar amount that you can put on a medicine bag. It's like, something that was given to me while I was born, something that's very important to me that I would like to have back. But unfortunately, I asked the chaplain to give it back to me. I said, why don't you just give it back? I can send it out. I got the pieces of paper that saying that, where I'm asking the chaplain, well, it was still in his possession, to let me put a stamp on it and send it back to my family.
And the department acknowledges they made a mistake and their policy on that medicine bag was wrong, to just hand it to Mr. Davis.
I even asked him if I could sew it up myself, and he wouldn't listen to that either.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things we can't go back and fix, that this was really a difficult one for us to deal with. So I'd really like to try, and I didn't realize that you came from such a long distance, so we'd like to make it so you don't have to come back regardless of what happens. And so is there additional testimony or information you'd like us to know, assuming you're not going to be, you don't, either don't contact or deal with Mr. Davis, or he's not able to help, or you're not able to find it? What else do we need to know in trying to determine what our claim recommendation would be to the legislature?
Well,
if you'd identify yourself for the record, sir.
Yeah, my name is Fred Shalapo. I'm from Barrington, Michigan, and this is my son, Minnow. And we have take a great deal of importance in our religion, and especially the medicine bag that I was partly gave it to him when he was a baby. And we think that's very, very important, and that the chaplain at the prison mishandled that. Hey, the first time I ever heard a chaplain at prisons mishandle Indian medicine or religion artifacts that the inmates have. And I don't know, I think Minow, what I hear is Minow wants to have that chaplain corrected somehow, and I don't know, we don't know where to go with that either, so.
Yes.
I think he has such a paper trail from the time of November 6th for every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. that I don't know if we're going to go into litigation with it or not. I think so, maybe we will.
If that is a possibility, you need to let us know that also, because that would need to occur first before you'd come to the committee, you know, before we make a decision on it. We're kind of a court of last resort type of thing. So if there's potential for a litigation, and I don't know underneath our, what you'd have to talk to lawyers about that, but if that's a possibility, then you may want to consider that before we proceed with any decision.
Well, the legal trail is that, you know, we got to exhaust all the administrative remedies before we can go to the court, so that's what we're here.
Okay. Any other information that you'd like to offer, help us in with this decision, assuming we come down to a point where we have to make a claim decision?
Hello. My name is Peggy Shelafo. I am Minogishik's stepmother, and I am a traditional woman in our tribe. And you cannot place a value on your belief system, which is revered as any other religion would have it. And what Minogishik has gone through to try and get that medicine bag back, and the, excuse the terminology, bureaucratic BS that went on to with him on trying to get this remedied has not helped at all. And they did not take it as seriously as he did. And I mean, he's been quite stressed about this, because this is something that you cannot. He's had it since the day he was born. And there are many things in there that are protecting. To place a value there really can't be, but there is a lot of importance in our belief system on why he really needs to have that. And without it, it's like a part of him is lost, like losing an arm. So there's going to be quite a problem trying to get to the bottom of this.
Okay.
That's what I see.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you all for making the long trip here, and we appreciate your willingness to do that, and we're, of course, concerned about how we can resolve this in a way that is helpful to you. And I have a question. What happens in the case where others who have this kind of loss occur? What do they do then? If some other person has a medicine bag that they maybe get stolen from them, or they misplace it. I don't know if that's even conceivable the way you describe it, that it could be misplaced. But I assume that in some other circumstances, someone could lose their medicine bag. And what typically is the recourse that you would see for that circumstance?
Most people don't allow their medicine bag to even leave their neck, and I wasn't. And the COs forced it off of me. You know what I mean? I was ready to fight while they were trying to take it off. And they held me down and took it off and gave it to the chaplain.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
and yeah. Just to follow up, I understand it's not something you willingly did.
The only time you take it off is if you're in the shower.
Right.
But traditional Ojibwe, it doesn't ever leave your neck.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is that I'm sure that there have been other cases where people have lost their bags. I'm just trying to understand what the recourse has been in those circumstances, that we might use that as perhaps some pattern of how we might try to resolve this if it turns out to be a permanent loss, which, as Representative Osmond has suggested, maybe there is a way to find it. But if not, in attempting to resolve it, you said that you can't really put a monetary value on that, and yet that's what this panel is required to do.
Yeah,
so, how in trying to struggle with that, I'm trying to say in other times when people have had a loss,
I have no idea if anybody else has ever lost one.
Okay.
I'm sure it's happened in the past, but no, I can't speak on that.
Mr. Windicke.
Mr. Chair, just one more question. Putting a monetary loss or trying to get recovery for its value is one thing, but do you know of anybody else in your band or any place else who has lost one of these accidentally somewhere? How do they restore it? I mean, I realize you can't restore the items from your birth and from your original rites and ceremonies and stuff like that, things from your grandfather. I know you can't restore that, but do people make up new medicine bags?
I'm sure they do, but I ain't got one on since I got mine taken from me.
Okay.
Well, I don't think he can restore it. He's got his umbilical cord on it in there.
I know. I realize it can't be restored, but on the other hand, I wondered if, although you can't have all those original items clearly because they're not available anymore, whether people, when they do lose one, and it must happen ever, are able to create a new one of some kind that will be of some use.
What I think is that Chaplain Schaefer has kept it and pushed it off on Lee Staples and Greg Davis, because they as Native Americans should know that's wrong, you know what I mean? And I try to tell the chaplain that myself.
It may be a question that you need to talk to Mr. Davis about. And I can, after reading your report, all I did is I went on the internet to try and find Mr. Davis, because we did have an address that we were provided by the department where they tried to send him a letter. And so knew that pinpointed him up at Mille Lacs. And so on the internet, I was able to come up with the Mr. Davis, who is a director of community youth services for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. And I believe that if you can contact him, that would be a really good first step to try and recover that bag, because I don't know of any other way to do it. He did say he had possession of it at one point. He did say he told Mr. Lindeke that somebody stole his car, and that when he got the car back, the items in the car, including the medicine bag, were gone. And he thought he knew who had stolen the car, but individuals indicated they didn't know where they had disposed of any of the contents. Their memory may be jogged a little more if you have some contact up there yourself. I don't know if that's a good idea or a bad idea. I'm just saying it's a possibility for you. And I can give you the phone numbers and of the people, and That's about the best we can do at this point. We would like you to get back in contact with us, though, and let us know what happened, and so we know as to what we, how we need to proceed. And if you're going to take legal action, you should probably do that before you come back to the committee. Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to Mr. Salmon and your family, you weren't able to be here at the first hearing, but I want you to know how seriously we did recognize your loss, and that at least it has had some good impact in terms of, it appears from the people who spoke on behalf of the Department of Corrections, has changed procedure, and they're not letting things out of the facility, and they're much more, the procedures have definitely gone back to a situation where we hope we will never ever hear this kind of a claim again. It doesn't restore the one that you've lost, but I do want you to know that it has had some impact in terms of future situations.
There's you indicated that you're a member of the Ojibwe tribe, and you may want to talk right directly with the chief up there, chief executive of the Mille Lacs Band, because they operate, you know, the casinos up there, and it is, and I know that their conversations with us has always been on a friendly basis, and I think that they may be very sympathetic and try to help do the best they can to recover that bag. That's the best I can offer you today.
I think that one of the most important things that is medicine bag is that stitch on there, that, you know, the beadwork that was covered on it. His grandmother put that stitch on there, and it's a double stitch. No one else does that kind of stitch anymore.
Sure.
You know, in Anishinaabe land, you know, so.
We've been doing some research on it. I mean, I have pictures of what some medicine bags look like. We've done other things trying to get ourselves better informed as to what your situation is. And as we're, you know, empathetic, but we don't have the ability to do anything about it because the bag's gone. Maybe you'll be able to make contacts with the right people and that may be able to talk to those kids or somebody.
I think it's kind of pointless because he said they lost it. You know what I mean? So why would I contact him? That would just,
if you could
make
find
me
a,
angry.
Find the individuals that had control of it at one
that
time.
That would be a bad idea to give me that address and phone number, sir.
Okay.
Could I make
all right? One? Anything else before the committee? Yes.
One thing that you do need to know about Anishinaabe people is some of us are traditionals, which means that we follow our religion religiously.
Okay.
And there are others that don't. And there are some that purport to be medicine men or important people, but they pay. They make people pay for their wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Anishinaabe people, those that are traditional, there is no price that we ever put on anything that has to do with our religion.
Okay.
So it's just so that you understand that we're not all the same. It's like some are Catholic, some are Protestant, some are Muslim. We are Anishinaabe.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. That's helpful to me.
Okay.
Any other questions from members? Okay, we will lay this claim over and wait to hear as to what you're able to determine for your future direction as you want to take.
Thank you. Well,
how do I get a hold of the back to you guys?
We'll make certain. Mr. Wendeke?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sandman, you can call me or you can call the claims clerk. I'll write down my phone number and the claims subcommittee's
phone
number.
We'll give you a slip here with the numbers on it that you can
and
get
I,
back to.
I'd be happy to talk with you anytime, and I hope to talk with Mr. Davis again. I'm even tempted to drive up there and have a chat with him. We'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We've laid the claim over for the time being. And now, Mr. Lindeke, what?
Well, Senator Latz isn't here, and the Senate Council was here.
They're meeting
Mr.
in
Chair,
the hall.
They're out in the hall.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Going back to that or going back?
Well, we just... wait a moment and see if Senator Latz is coming back. Do we have another case that we could deal with in the meantime?
Do we want to go back to the Baker claim?
Okay. Are you ready to? Senator or Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I think that the Bakers incurred some significant costs related to the situation that started with the seeking of the well. And I think that the cost that would have been covered had it been a typical well drilling from what we heard before would be they would cover the tree removal of $200, the well digging $700, the oil tank removal would have been approximately $1,000, and then the re-landscaping, he had $400 for the re-sodding and a fairly large expenditure for the tree replanting. I'm prepared to recommend a settlement of $2,500, which would not include the $1,000 for his time and effort, even though I know it was very frustrating to him and his wife. And it would only include $200 for planting some new trees rather than the $1,600 estimate they had gotten from Bachman's. So that would be a $2,500 proposed settlement.
Okay. Representative Loeffler moves to have a $2,500 to settle the Baker claim. Discussion. Okay. Everyone understands the motion. All in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair,
aye.
Excuse me.
All right, hold it.
Let me just ask, as part of this motion, you were talking about having some of that, were you talking about having some of that come from the petrol fund
department?
That's the Department of Commerce, oddly enough.
Okay. The
to pay for at least the oil tank part of that.
Okay. Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chairman, I have some hesitancy about signing that to the Commerce Department simply because, given the circumstances, it sounded like he would not have been able to make that claim. And although I did have some concerns about how the Department of Commerce handled it, the fact is that they were dealing with it right away. The main instigator of all of this was the Department of Health, and it seems to me that it ought to be the Department of Health that bears the major responsibility, because the tank would not have come up as an issue, even been identified, even if the law says you have to pull it if you find it. So I'm hesitant to split it between the agencies.
So
Representative Loeffler, but I'm open to advice from others on the committee.
Representative Loeffler, I think that it's possible we could just identify it to come out of the petrol fund, which wouldn't really be the Department of Commerce itself, but a specific fund within that department. I think they said that there were some dollars there that could cover that. Mr. Lindeke,
And Mr. Chair, I just want to know, when I draft the bill, we're not going to be asking the Department of Health to pay it out of their existing budget, the rest of this or all of it, whatever Representative Loeffler determines the motion is. But we would be appropriating money to them, as we usually do in the claims bill, to pay this claim. Is that correct?
That's my understanding as to how it works, unless we would make some other specifics. But I'm thinking that there may be dollars available in the petrol fund that could be utilized to take care of $1,000, this which would be very legitimate. Mr. Fisher, would you come back up and give me your opinion as to whether that's am I characterizing it appropriately? I think what I heard you say was that the reason that it was not eligible was because it really didn't fall within the parameters of your statutory responsibilities as outlined. But if we made that determination and put it into law, that would take care of that problem, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I believe it would. If I could just clarify one quick thing, too, is we actually never got a claim for this, and we never have received a claim. I was just giving the example. If we would have, that's how we would have handled it. But yes, the Petra Fund is a separate, there's a separate fee and it's a separate fund from the Department of Commerce. So, and there is sufficient funds to cover $1,000.
Mr. Chairman, based on that, then I would concur with you that we ought to have the Petro Fund rather than the general fund pick up the tank costs.
It's up to $1,000, mm-hmm. as was testified. Okay, so out of the $2,500, it would be $1,500 Department of Health, General Fund, and then it would be $1,000 Department of Commerce, Petro Fund. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hand.
I just wanted to, before we voted on the motion, I agree with Representative Loeffler generally that her structure for this makes sense to me. I guess I would wonder if she'd be willing to accept a friendly amendment. As you outlined the cost, you indicated that we would offer $200 for the landscaping issues rather than the $1,600 that they say they incurred. And I'm wondering if we tried to maybe split the difference with them on that, and that would increase the claim amount by maybe another $500 or $600, and if that would be an acceptable amendment to the structure that was proposed. And I'm not going to offer that as amendment yet until I get some sense from Representative Loeffler how she feels about increasing the amount to, in effect, split the cost of that landscaping process.
Mr. Chairman knows from my previous efforts in the legislature that I value trees as much as anyone in this body, and if we want to help them get a more mature replacement, I would agree to that recommendation.
And Mr. Chairman, then I would just offer an amendment to the Representative Loeffler's amendment that we change the $2,500 amount to $3,000. Would that be about the splitting? So to $3,000.
Okay, is that
that's acceptable.
Friendly
amendment.
Yeah, okay. I think Representative Loeffler will incorporate that into her motion. And so now, as I understand, the motion is $2,000 from Department of Health General Fund and $1,000 Department of Commerce Petro Fund. Any other, is that a total of $3,000?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Latz.
Were you intending for it to come out of the Department of Health's general fund budget, or in the more ordinary course of things, just come out of the general fund, or however we otherwise would fund the claims bill?
Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I would expect that I would draft the bill to appropriate the money from the general fund to the Department of Health to pay the $2,000 of this $3,000 that the Department of Health will be paying.
Okay. All right. Any further questions on the motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right. We will continue on with our claims. Mr. Lindeke, what would your suggestion be?
Well, Mr. Chair, the only claims we have left, I believe, unless the McEachrans are here.
Don't see them.
The only claims left are the claims against the Department of Corrections. We have actually two remaining prisoner property claims that were received late and on which I've made recommendations. Hopefully Mr. Hartnett has seen them at some point as well. And then we have the Butters claim. So we have those three claims yet to deal with. Perhaps Mr. Hartnett would like to come up, and I can share with him my copies of the, if he doesn't have them, of the two property claims.
Mr. Hartnett.
Let me give you the copies that I put over here for Representative Consults, who won't be using them today, and his copy of another memo on the Butters claim.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, these two property claims, I think I gave one to each member as we recessed. One of them is Robin Morales, who's a woman at the correctional facility in Shakopee. Her claim is for damage to her sweatshirt and sweatpants, apparently by yellow water that the city of Shakopee unfortunately released into the prison. And what was interesting about this claim, although I recommend denial because there's not really any negligence by the state, but you might want to think about it for a moment, because they were apparently willing, and you could read their letter from the department, they were willing to pay for other people's yellowed clothing. It's just a matter of how yellow your clothing got. And apparently they determined that this one was minimal yellowing and still wearable, and therefore the claim must be denied. So it's one of those odd situations where it depends on how yellow your clothes are. But again, there was no real negligence by the state, but the subcommittee, I suppose, could reimburse this, have the department reimburse this woman $26 for the clothes that were damaged by the yellow water. It's up to the subcommittee, I'm sure.
Mr. Hartnett, could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Randolph Hartnett. I'm a claims officer from the Minnesota Department of Corrections. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, the two property claims that I have before me are property claims that I'm sure Ms. Lind sent over to your office in the due course, and I actually was under the impression we were simply going to be discussing Mr. Shelafo's claim as well as Mr. Butter's claim today. As for Ms. Morales's claim, I really don't know what to say. I have to assume on the basis of what Ms. Lind said that the damage to her clothing was probably minimal. I'm actually kind of surprised that they were reimbursing people for loss of a situation that the facility obviously didn't have any way of controlling. Speaking as an individual who gets yellow water from the city I live in with some frequency.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsling,
down here on the end. I would move to deny the Morales claim.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Hartnett, did in fact the department pay for the yellowed, ruined clothing of other inmates?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I don't know. I suppose that it would be possible that this did happen, and maybe on a basis that knowing that this was a situation that happened periodically, if they've gotten notice of it. I know that the city that I live in gives us notice when the water is going to turn yellow. And it may be that on occasions when they failed to do that, they may have. But this is the first time I've heard of this claim. So,
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Wendeke.
I just wanted to point out the paragraph in the department's letter from Nicole Lynn saying, several other offenders have indicated that they have had issues with clothing yellowing. Property staff replaced some of the offender state-issued items that were severely yellowed and did not replace the items that were minimally discolored. So those were state-issued items. I had the impression, however, that they also they denied replacing this clothing. So whether they paid for anybody's other clothing, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, the department does have a number of clothing items, and since my beginning with the subcommittee, the number of clothing items allowed at the Shakopee facility has decreased substantially, and we also have increased the numbers of pieces of clothing that are state-issued. For example, I believe all offenders now have a state-issued jacket. Those things are made in our industry program. Whether these sweatpants, this sweatsuit was made in our industry program or not, I'm not aware. I don't see anything that jumps out of me on the property list here that indicates that.
So Mr. Chair, in other words, there is no state negligence as far as I can tell on this one. And on the other claim, if you look at it briefly, it's James McCarty. There's a couple of books that he claims are missing, and I just wanted to point out that on my research on half.com, for the $5 that he spent filing this claim, he could have bought both of those books. So I wish he had done that instead of bringing the claim to us. And there's no evidence that he actually owned the books at the time he went to segregation or that that the state lost the book. So I guess I would recommend denial of both claims.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lantz.
With regard to the Morales claim, you know, in one sense, we don't have enough information to know whether the other discolored clothing was the state-issued clothing where they might have some reason to want to make sure everyone's got the same color. I don't know, but I'm a little troubled by, you know, the liability issue doesn't seem to be the question here if they've accepted at least enough concept of liability to replace the other people's clothing. On the other hand, I'm a little reluctant to step into the shoes of the Department of Corrections and decide how much yellowing is enough to ruin a set of clothes. So for that reason, I'm going to support the motion to deny the claim.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to modify my motion to include denial of the McCarty claim also.
We have, I think we'll, if you would hold on that until we actually have that before us, I'd appreciate it. Make it a little easier, I think, for our records. I haven't heard it. I haven't read the other one.
Oh, okay.
I don't like to vote on it until I've
heard
a brief description from counsel, and I trust him well, but I like to read it myself.
Mr. Chair, I attempted to briefly tell you about it. It's the loss of the two books that the guy claims were not there when he got packed up to go to segregation. And they agree they weren't there when he got packed up to go to segregation. They don't show up as having existed on the property sheet, the result of which is probably that he had lent them to somebody else. They weren't there when they packed up his room. We don't know where they went. In any event, they're negligible. They would cost him $5 to get copies of if he just spent the money.
Just give me a moment, Senator Roseline, and we'll take your motion as you presented it.
Mr. Chair, the book Mortal Prey is by a good Minnesota author, John Sanford, though. And I encourage the reading of that book.
And Mr. Chair, while others are pondering other things, I will note that Mr. McCarty didn't include in his claim the missing clear coffee cup with the drawing of Tweety Bird, which he had. This was the second time it had gone missing. So apparently the books are more valuable than the mug.
Okay, we have Senator Olsleen. Scenes. Get it right yet, or try to. Motion before us tonight, both claims, the McCarty claim and the Morales claim. Are there questions by members? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Claims are denied. Okay, we now
Mr.
have.
Chair, that gets us back to the Butters claim. And as you recall, at our last meeting, the motion was made to deny the claim. We were unable to get enough votes to deny it, and of course, we couldn't have then gotten enough votes to pay it either. So it remained on the table. And I believe I sent you all by mail material that Mr. Hartnett had left at the last meeting. And I also handed out to you a one-page memo from our law student claims clerk, Kimberly, on the subject. And I believe I also sent you all emails concerning the Butters claim in which I tried to argue both sides of the case. I argued on Mr. Butters' behalf that in our typical case from the Department of Corrections, people will slice off part of their finger or all of their finger in a wood shop, often using the equipment improperly. They've been instructed to use it otherwise, and we always have that in the claims that I told him how to use this, and he didn't put the guard in place, and he sawed off his finger. But because we treat these claims much like a workers' compensation system, We pay the claims whether they were careless or not, and we pay the claims if there is permanent partial injury, and don't look into exactly what happened to cause the claim. So treating this one as an unusual circumstance would be, I mean, I've never seen us do this before, where we actually look into the cause of the injury when the person was assigned duties and performing assigned duties. We would normally pay for the damage that's caused. And so this one is different. And on the other hand, the rest of my email to you was that Mr. Hartnett, in my experience, is an honest and very intelligent individual with his heart in the right place. And he has never before, in all the years, the 15 years I've been on the subcommittee, come to us and said, well, I'm pretty sure on this one that this guy sliced off his finger on purpose. So I want you to know that when Mr. Hartnett tells me something, I usually agree with him. I just don't quite agree with him on this one. And but it's up to the subcommittee as to what we're going to do. Hopefully we'll get a vote one way or another and deal with this claim.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Lindeke, for your thoughts. I looked at this and appreciate your sending to our homes and the information on this, which I have read through. And it does seem to me that if this was intentional, I think we do need to treat it differently, in that if it's a standard that if someone does themselves intentional harm, that they then become a successful claimant against the taxpayers, that's not a good statement to make. I don't think that we ought to suggest any way that intentional harming of yourself is a way to gain compensation. So to me, I think I tend to agree generally with what your comment was, that it doesn't really matter the circumstances. If someone's doing assigned duties and they hurt themselves, even if they should have known better or not, you know, did something that others wouldn't have done, it still is probably a permissible kind of claim. But I think this case, in my mind, turns on whether or not it was intentional. And I guess that's something that is the heart of the debate. And as I read through the material trying to assess that, it's hard to make a clear assessment of that. But I, at this point, I'm persuaded that it seems more likely that it was than accidental. I've tried to figure out how he could have done what he did accidentally, and that has not become clear to me. So even though is it an intern or your student worker wrote the fine memo about her beliefs on this, I think it does make a difference whether or not the action was something that was done intentionally.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Representative Latz, or Senator Latz, sorry.
Quite all right. As others have said, I've been promoted.
That's right.
My view is that intent is kind of a tough thing to get your arms around. But, you know, in criminal law, intent, which is a product of bad intent, which is a product of mental illness, is considered to be no vitiating circumstance. You're not convicted if you intentionally killed someone, but your intent was a product of your psychiatric illness, your mental illness. So you really couldn't meaningfully form the kind of culpable criminal intent that's intended to be punished. It seems to me that we've got at least a pretty strong conclusion from the Department of Corrections themselves that Mr. Butters was struggling with a mental illness. They had been notified, at least had a history of mental problems, recommending to keep him away from sharp objects. Department of Corrections had been notified of that, yet he was still placed in a position where he had access to sharp objects. So I think it's a tough thing to struggle with. Even if he was so mentally demented that he decided he would intentionally cut off his finger so that he could make a claim before the claim committee, if that's a product of his delusional mental processes, where he could have been protected if the Department of Corrections had avoided placing him in this position. I think, on balance, I'd be in support of the claim, granting the claim.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Latz, I tend to agree with you. I think that you're right, that if that a mental condition could bear on the intent. I guess a question maybe for the department or the representative, if they know, what has been the position? There is documentation to suggest that they were aware or believed that this individual had some issues with his mental state and that there were recommendations to be kept away from sharp objects. Did they make a conscious decision to place him in a kitchen with knives despite that, or did they change their opinion that hasn't been documented, or what would be the circumstances that would say if you've decided this guy is not stable and he shouldn't be around sharp objects, then you put him in the kitchen and assign him the duty of cutting carrots, how do you square those things? What has the department concluded on the basis of that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, one of the unfortunate facts is that approximately 40% of our prison population are on psychotropic medications. So it could be argued that we have a very large minority of our prisoners who meet that having mental illness as an issue. In this particular case, I don't think that there's any doubt that Mr. Butters has psychiatric issues. Throughout the psychiatric file, which I read, which was voluminous, there are issues about his possibly having bipolar disorder. However, they also said that it was possible that he had a personality disorder, which probably describes close to 100% of our offenders. With regard to the keeping him away from sharps, in January of 2004, Mr. Butters was claiming that he was having command hallucinations. In other words, voices telling him to, I don't remember the specific quote, but I believe it was something like to end it. Okay. At that point, he was put on what's called close observation status. If any of you have ever worked in a psychiatric facility, that basically means suicide precautions. As part of suicide precautions, obviously keeping him away from sharps was part of that. 2 days later, he spoke with another psychologist. He told that psychologist that the reason he was hearing voices was because he hadn't slept, and that now that he had slept, he was no longer hearing those voices. He disclaimed having any suicidal intent, and as you'll notice from the materials I submitted, yes, he was evaluated and under care for the next 2 years, but at each point where it was evaluated as to whether he had either a psychotic process going or a suicidal process going, that was denied. So the question is, yes, he had mental problems. Yes, he had mental issues. But would it have risen to the point where they would have put him on suicide precautions, which the facilities take very seriously? No, it hadn't. Would it rise to the level of the McNaughton test, which is that he ought to be relieved of any responsibility for his decisions? I don't believe that there's any evidence that supports that.
Other questions? Representative Laughlin.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we approve the claim of Mr. Butters.
Okay, Representative Loeffler moves that the claim be approved. There are further, let's see, Senator Latz coming back?
I think he's just out in the hall.
I know he spoke on this issue, so I'm sure he's going to want to vote on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
I guess I appreciate the clarification, and notwithstanding Senator Latt's concern about the intent and the mental condition that may have a bearing on or a mitigating effect on one's intentional behavior. I guess the way I'm leaning right now is that I think that there are some judgment calls that were made along the way in terms of whether this person should be working in a kitchen and doing what he's doing, and I think that from the documentation and the evidence, I think that that judgment call is at least supportable. if not accurate. So I guess I remain with the idea that I'm reluctant to reward a self-inflicted wound with compensation from taxpayers. So my inclination at this point is to not support the Loeffler motion and suggest that we should not approve this claim.
The motion is before us to approve the Butters' claim. Any further questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
The motion does not prevail. There is, I heard, two noes, correct?
Yes.
Okay. See, the claim is not being decided at this point, evidently, unless there's going to be a motion to deny, and if that prevails.
And Mr. Chair, I was troubled by the prior subcommittee on claims under Senator Skoglund, briefly troubled, because Senator Skoglund would say, hearing no motion to pay the claim is denied, which it struck me was at odds with how this subcommittee had always operated in the past, which was that you have to make either a motion to pay it or deny it. And then as part of looking through the big book of our minutes from 90-whatever to 90-whatever, 91, I think, to 97 or something like that, in an attempt to piece together the van claim and the payments on that, I actually encountered one time, possibly while both of us were on the subcommittee, working on it, and I think there was a time when the claim not having been approved, it was considered denied. So it has ever happened. So we can either leave it open and hope that at some point in the future, Senators Han or Olsen change their mind, or we can find some way to get beyond it.
And Mr. Chairman?
Their hand.
I am certainly willing to offer a motion to deny the claim if that would expedite this process. I don't know if the vote could be taken that would resolve it. If it's a tie vote, I guess.
Mr. Chair, in the past, Representative Onseltz being here, who voted against the claim, he might have, and if somebody changed his mind or her mind on the House side, then you might get that, but I think... I don't know.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, it's not very often that we deadlock, but it's always on these cases that are gray, no matter whether they're big cases or little cases. And one thing that I would be willing to do is to entertain a motion to have a lesser lesser financial award. I believe that this amount is set on the workers' compensation schedule, since there does seem to be some doubt amongst the members of the committee as to the intent and the degree of mental health impairment that might excuse that behavior. I would be willing to entertain a lesser amount if that might break the deadlock. I don't know. I'd like to hear from the people who are voting against this to see if they think that might be take away any incentive for going through this process where you wait a year to get any financial compensation for whatever harm you've incurred. I don't know that that's a big incentive to injure yourself, but I would be willing to break the deadlock on that kind of a basis.
That help me there?
I have a question that is related to if, in fact, it used to be that by denying a claim or not voting yes, it meant it was denial. If a motion was made to deny a claim and that was voted against, would that in fact mean that the claim was approved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, that never happened. No.
I ran into it on our county board. We had an issue like that. But I my position on this one is, you know, it just seems to me like I've toured the Minnesota Extended Treatment where they have people with mental illnesses in the kitchen every day. You know, the knives are there. Somebody's, you know, and we heard the testimony, probably 40% of our prisoners fall under these same categories. If they were no longer going to work in the system, it would kind of put the system on hold. And so I'm just not supportive of this one. But I am interested in what you're talking about, maybe dropping the settlement down to a lesser number. I don't know what number I would move on that. I'd be interested in a dollar, but I so somewhere in between those two numbers, I guess we could find something.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
since our comments were invited from those of us who opposed the original motion, I guess you could support a lower dollar amount, but if you say, well, we want to have such a low dollar amount that it is in effect a trivial or symbolic kind of compensation, I'm not sure that I see much merit in doing that. And I think anything that gets beyond a trivial amount of money, then you get back to the same position that I'm struggling with, which is you are in effect suggesting that it's possible for someone to do themselves intentional harm and make a claim against the taxpayers, and I'm somewhat reluctant to do that. So I'm not sure that I'm completely in sync with the intent of the motion, although I do believe it would be good to try to get some resolution for this.
I hear, Representative, that there may be possibilities, but it probably needs to be discussed further, and so we'll lay the butter's claim over for a while. We have Representative Atkins here, and we'd like to bring his issue up.
Mr. Chair, while Representative Atkins is coming forward to talk, and possibly the McEachrans with him, everybody should be given a copy by maybe, where's Mr. Dwight? Is he still here? Could you hand copies of that stuff to each of the members of the subcommittee? This is Department of Transportation stuff. Mr. Chair, I don't know that I've got a whole lot to say. I'm sure Representative Atkins does. This is the McEachran claim. You recall that somebody put some material on this land in Invergrove Heights, and some of it has asbestos on it. And it was unclear whether it was the Department of Transportation's stuff that had the asbestos on it or somebody else's. And we've talked about this a good deal, and now we have a packet of material that was delivered to us yesterday afternoon. At least I saw my copy of it yesterday afternoon, and which is so much stuff about bridges and design that I wasn't really able to go through it carefully, and we don't know exactly what it means.
Thank you. Representative Atkins, thank you for coming back to the committee. I'm hoping that you have worked things out to where we don't have to go through all this stuff. Please tell us you have some answers.
Mr. Chair, that is certainly our goal, and I would first like to thank the MnDOT folks for putting the materials together. They pulled out all of the plans and blueprints for the various bridges that were demolished as part of the 494. These are all the state bridges. You'll see that on their cover sheet. It wasn't a small amount of work for them to do that, and I appreciate it very much, and I know that the McEachrans do as well. It cleared up one thing, which is that it was not pilings that were placed in the McEachran's yard. In fact, it was piping. And I have kind of a summary. Maybe if there's one of the page folks that appreciate it, in some, what happened was that the and we have Mr. Havinger here, who is an expert on the topic as well, who can walk you through the documents themselves. But it became very clear that it was the piping that ran along the bridges, and when the bridges were demolished, that piping that was used for erosion and is coated with the same sort of mastic coating that was found on the pipes in the McEachran's yard, the same mastic coating that had the asbestos on it. There were no other bridges, you recall from the last time we visited. There were no city bridges, no county bridges, no federal bridges. Nobody else's bridges were taken down during this period of time. It was simply those state bridges in association with the state project that was going on at the time. Those bridges, and it's clear, you'll recall from the photos that were in the original Red Book, that is obviously a bridge that was put in what came to be the McEachran's yard. The black items that turned out to have the asbestos on them that is not in question are the same pipes that run alongside these bridges, and they are the pipes that had asbestos that needed to be removed. It became very clear once we had the drawings, so again, I very much appreciate the help from MnDOT. With that, with your deference, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Havinger. We've got from the MnDOT drawings, he can walk you through exactly what you're looking at. And we've got copies for all of the committee members as well that are tabbed. You'll see green tabs on them to point out to you what's at issue. So, again, if I might have one of our pages or assistants to pass these out to the committee members and staff. Thank you.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, who you represent.
My name is Charles Habiger. I live in Hopkins, Minnesota, and I've been assisting the McEachrans through this ordeal of theirs to get their site cleaned up and just taking them through the process.
What do you have to offer us?
Well, this morning we came after MnDOT supplied copies of their bridge plans that they dug out of their archive files, and we looked at the plans to find out, you know, what materials would have been specified on these bridges that were consistent with the materials discovered in the demolition debris on the McEachran's property, you know, during the that was discovered during the construction of their residence. And we reviewed all the schedule of quantities and determined that the bridge pilings were either timber or H-beams, and there were no tubular steel pilings located on the site as what we originally thought was the most logical source of the materials. But then we also, in reviewing the plans, we discovered, and if you look at these on the sheets where the green tabs are right here, the arrows point to the storm drainage. There's catch basins up at the curb of the bridge, and then a 12-inch diameter pipe that flows into an erosion control box. And the material is, you know, if you go down to the schedule of quantities on the Concord Avenue Bridge, it indicates 12-inch metal pipe flange. And the estimated quantity for bidding purposes was 75 lineal feet. Now, the contractor who constructed the bridge used steel pipe, welded the sections together, buried it under the ground, and would have, under MnDOT requirements way back in the 52 specifications for the Minnesota Transportation Highway manuals, would have required the mastic asbestos coating on the steel that was buried on the site to eliminate or reduce corrosion. Now, the quantities of the materials listed on these bridges, either one of these two bridges, would have been consistent with the amount of materials that were discovered on the McEachran site. One of the things I was concerned about was if it had been bridge pilings, there would have been a lot more material, and I felt that was buried out on that site waiting to, you know, as a ticking time bomb. This is actually kind of good news from the standpoint that that was probably the extent of the asbestos material that was out on the site where these erosion control features or the steel pipes that were built to handle the stormwater runoff.
Could I just ask one question? I had the impression when we talked about all this last time, Representative Atkins, or you, sir, that these, somebody checked and inside some of these things were filled, and therefore they could have been pilings. But these pipes were not filled with anything?
No.
Okay.
And I, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lindeke, there was a question that never resolved of whether or not they had been filled. So I can understand where the question came from. But they weren't filled at the time that they were found.
All right. Here, Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm just trying to get an understanding of this. The claim for $82,000 is a reimbursement for the cost to deal with this pipe. I guess the question I'm trying to, and maybe somewhere in the documentation, I can't lay my hands on it, but what is the, why is it so costly? What is the makeup of that cost? It seems to me if you've got some pipes in your yard and you find them and you say, well, let's get rid of them, and it shouldn't take you $82,000 to find a way to dispose of that.
You know, that's a good logical conclusion to come to, but the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has very well-defined protocol or procedures that must be followed when asbestos material is found on a site and how it has to be dealt with. 2 feet of the topsoil from the McEachran's property had to be stripped from the site, and it can't just be located in a truck. I mean, it's, you know, the trucks are lined with poly and covered, and there's a lot of water involved in the process of wetting material. It's hauled to a special landfill. There's special consultants and special training for the workmen that transport the materials. Then a geotextile fabric is placed over the site, and then 2 feet of clean fill is brought in to cover any material so that there's no chance of that friable asbestos that's introduced into the soil to be ever become airborne. And then there's also certain restrictions on the property as far as what kind of planting they can do on their landscaping and things like that. But that's generally, I mean, basically that's why there's so much cost involved. It's not just removing two pieces of pipe. Unfortunately, the pipe had become friable and contaminated the soils when the materials flaked off the pipe, and it's highly friable material.
Mr. Chair, if I might just to
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, to give you real numbers with respect to that, I think the total figure is somewhere in the neighborhood of $170,000 to $175,000. The McEachrans have a lot out of pocket in addition to this 82 that's been assessed against their property. They have, I believe, if I remember right, in the neighborhood of about $30,000 out of pocket for landscaping. There were supplemental environmental projects that were performed on this site that accounted for another $40,000 to $60,000. The city contributed $15,000. The county contributed staff time as well as other time and effort into the project. And the figure now with all of that, and at the last hearing, it was noted that the claim is actually $67,000 because of the city's contribution was not involved at the time. So they have bent over backwards to try to reduce the claim to the city or to the state as much as they possibly could. And it's still a big amount of money.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the effort of everyone to play whodunit, and it's kind of fun. But it's also, you know, important to be accurate, and we've only just seen this big packet here. But what caught my attention was on the handout that you have. It talks about 12-inch metal pipe flumes. And in the notes from the technical company that did the engineering analysis for the PCA, the technician notes it as 8-inch pipe. And I'm noting in the cover letter from the Department of Transportation that there's a reference to 8-inch sanitary sewer pipe for which apparently MnDOT pulled a permit with the city. And it looks to me like, at least by diameter, that may be more likely it than the 12 inches that's called for in the specifications, because I would assume that our bridge or MnDOT people make sure we get delivered whatever we put in the specifications.
Okay.
So there's a diameter thing here that's lining up yet.
The field technician that went out never measured the pipe from the EPA when they tested the material coating on the pipe. He just said 8-inch diameter pipe. It kind of looked good, but, he never measured the diameter of it. The material never measured the diameter of the pipe. And the pipe was actually closer to 12 inches, a 12-inch diameter, what was actually there. Because I saw it myself. The technician who collected the sample from the pipe and tested it, he just labeled it as an 8-inch pipe, but he never measured the diameter of the pipe.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Laffa.
I'm sorry, but can you tell me why you know that he didn't measure it in putting together his notes?
Because I was there when he sampled the material. He didn't have a tape measure with him to measure the diameter of the pipe. He just collected a sample of the coating that was still on the outside of the pipe. That's what he was interested in, not so much the diameter of the pipe. 2.5 years ago when that testing was done, nobody anticipated being in front of a state legislative hearing concerning, the issues of diameter of the pipe and where the material came from and things like that. The other thing, the material is steel. It was steel pipe. And the MnDOT permit for the 8-inch sanitary sewer and also, I believe, an 8-inch water main aren't consistent. They, municipal water mains are made from ductile iron pipe, and they have flanges on the pipe, and they're friction fit together. And same way with sanitary sewer lines are generally constructed out of concrete or materials back in the 50s or whatever. It wasn't until about the 1980s when they started using the PVC plastic materials for sanitary sewer purposes.
Mr. Chair, just one additional point, and that is if you look at the photographs, Representative Loeffler, the piping in question, number one, in terms of size, just from looking at it, it appears to be larger than 8 inches, but it was also found amidst the bridge. The demolished bridge components. There's giant, large as a person, pieces of bridge, and the pipe in question was found amidst those bridge components.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lindeke.
Could I just ask, you've convinced me you're an expert on this, but what is your profession and what's your experience in the area of this stuff?
Well, I'm a trained architect, and I do urban planning. The primary area of my practice is brownfield redevelopment work. I primarily work for cities that are cleaning up different contaminated sites for ultimate redevelopment. That's my area of expertise.
Your hand.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to this cost that the real cost of 130 or whatever the total amount was. It has been brought down to now $67,000. And I guess the question I would ask is, in the course of following the procedures that have been spelled out by the EPA and the other laws that would pertain to cleaning this material up, was there any assessment in this particular case of the magnitude of the risk that this material posed to the people who lived in the neighborhood? Or, is that ever taken into consideration if you say, well, we've got this material and the requirements are it's this kind of material, and so therefore we go through these processes that you described, regardless of whether or not it is a hazard? I mean, was there ever any attempt to decide how hazardous that material was and whether it warranted the level of cost that was applied to abate that hazard? I mean, is that something that is just not done, or in this case, was it done and
ideally,
determined to be?
Ideally, a cost-benefit analysis is generally performed every time a site is looked at as far as the level of cleanup that's required for the site before redevelopment or, you know, or encapsulation or abatement of the property. In this particular case, there were three different types of asbestos materials or asbestos-containing materials that were found on the site. There was some mastic coating on an old water main, section of water main, the same type of mastic coating as the steel pipe, and then there was some transite that was found on the site. The mastic coating material is usually is considered quite friable, and it as the MPCA, as a general rule, if that material is found on a site, then they kind of go right past the cost-benefit analysis right into the it's got to be cleaned up because it's highly susceptible to become airborne. And an air, you know, asbestos that's airborne, you know, is that's a real exposure to, you know, people, and so that's a serious issue. If it were just the transite that was on the site, something else probably could have been some lower, lesser degree of cleanup could have been done on the site instead of removing the top 2 feet of the site and, you know, those types of issues. But because of the type of material, that mastic coating on that steel pipe and that water main, it kind of triggered the MPCA's air quality division to require this to have a full-scale cleanup of the site.
Mr. Chairman?
Chairman.
And I appreciate that, and I guess I'm wrestling a little bit here with, you know, this is material that is been in this site for quite a while, apparently, before it was discovered and asked to be removed. And I'm just a little concerned that maybe the whole process and the costs incurred to deal with it might have been a little bit excessive considering the magnitude of the problem. I find it hard to believe that material that had been there that long would require the excavation, for example, of the top 2 feet of the topsoil and those kinds of things. And I do understand that asbestos can be a problem, but I think the circumstances that surround the exposure and the management of it are what contribute to the hazard. And in the case that we're talking about here, I'm just thinking that the costs that were applied to deal with this were probably, you know, taking to the extreme, and that it probably is very likely that this could have been cleaned up at a much lower cost with virtually no change in the hazard that was being engaged by the people who lived in the neighborhood. So I'm wrestling with this because I don't think it's right that the property owner should have to be on the hook for this amount of money for a cleanup that is being required by the state, and particularly for something that they did not cause in the first place. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Han, if I might, I can assure you that there was considerable, and not just by me, but obviously much more by Pastor McEachran and his wife and Mr. Habiger, with respect to whether or not this was what was absolutely necessary. Many, many times that discussion was had because ultimately it was going to end up possibly on their backs. And so it was had countless occasions. And this, after much wrestling around, was what they determined to be the least invasive but effective method to deal with it.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Olsley.
I went to the official Veterans Memorial Ceremony. It was in Inver Grove Heights. And I had a discussion with two city council members from Inver Grove Heights. And it was very interesting. They were very sympathetic towards the family on this. And their description to me was that this ran into an overzealous county environmental person or staff person at the county, that their interpretation was that, you know, this might have been a small potatoes, but they blew the thing way out of proportion. And that came from two city council members from Inver Grove Heights who have already committed $15,000 to this. So, but that brings me to the point is, isn't there more room for county pitching in on this? I suppose they're facing budgets like everybody else. But.
Well, and I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't know if the county folks are represented here today, but I do know that if you were to ask them, and they have sent, I think, a letter, I know that in talking with them, they and Pastor McEachran might know better, but they contributed all of their, I think, all of their staff time. They also waived fees that would ordinarily have been collected. I think their contribution, John, is it somewhere in the neighborhood, 40, 50 grand they represent it to be?
Yes, 40, 50.
I don't mean to put words in their mouth if that's not exactly right, but that's my recollection of what they've indicated in the past in terms of their trying to help.
And Mr. Chairman, John McEachran, we did appeal to the county commissioners. That was part of the process. We went to three meetings with the county commissioners, one a working meeting, two board meetings, to appeal and ask for further assistance, and they felt that they did what they could.
Okay. Anything else that you want to present before we listen and have the department come up?
All right. Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Representatives from the department?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the council. My name is Mike Ligard. I was here last time we met on this, and I'm the construction support and claims engineer for MnDOT.
Hey, Mr. Ligard, anything that you saw what has been presented in some of the conclusions that has been drawn by the McEachrans and Representative Atkins, anything that you want to add to that or subtract from or whatever?
You know, I just received the information that they presented, but in fairness to the McEachrans, I was at a meeting all morning on the Wakota Bridge, and they did try to contact me at about 10 o'clock with a couple of questions. And when I called back, there was no answer. So I think we passed each other right before the meeting. The first thing that maybe jumps out to me, and I'm not an expert on pipe, and so I don't know. I know that I agree with what you folks said as far as the documentation that I had uncovered referenced 8-inch pipe, and then we struggled with whether or not it was filled or not, because we've never driven piling, but I think now we've moved past the piling and now maybe we're into more something that would carry a liquid, whether it was sanitary sewer or water pipe or something. So I don't, on the plan sheets where they're referencing the 12-inch pipe, CM, and I'm not sure if the C stands for cast, so that would be a fairly easy thing to tie down on whether or not the ductile iron is the business with the flanges and bolted together, or if the cast metal. So I suppose that would be one thing that we could kind of figure out. Along with the information that I had sent you, we did what we said we would do. We went through and we looked at the entire stretch of 494 from the river up to where 494 kind of deviated from Highway 110 and started breaking new ground. And so we did tabulate all of that in order to reference the piling in each one of the bridges. At the last meeting, and I think it was one of the senators asked at the end of the meeting, what do you think the pipe is? So the other thing that I've attached for you, that was not too hard of a database query for us to run. I think it's probably like the second to the last. I'm going to have to look here. I apologize. I'm a little... Yeah, it's the... There's a stapled... 8.5 by 11. So what we submitted to you folks and in order to the McEachrans, this is just a listing of all of the permits that have been taken out along what we call control section 1985. In 1985 would just be a number, a designation number for this section of roadway. The 19 is the county, and then 85 is just an arbitrary segment of road. And so the listing that you have there is would be all the utility permits that our utility office has that folks have applied to us to do utility work from the river bridge along the old 110, now 494 corridor, to 35E. We did submit the reason that I added this this one permit is that the time and the size of the pipe caught my eye. I don't want to sit here in front of you today and tell you that this permit number 85 U98 is what I would contend is the pipe that we found, because the only reason I submitted it was simply because we had printed it out that morning and I didn't want to, you know, submit it at a later date. I felt that, you know, we should turn over everything we had up to that point. So I do not want to tell you that I think that this 8-inch ductile iron pipe is the pipe that we found, or is the pipe that the McEachrans ran into, but it was one that I was interested in looking at, and so I printed it out, but I think you'd have to know more about it. The permit would have been the city of Invergrove Heights having a water pipe within our right-of-way, and they would be required to move it as in order to allow us to do our construction work in that area. And it kind of fit up with when I interviewed the gentleman that had spoke on behalf of the claim and hauling the pipes, it fit the time and the location. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, maybe he had some water pipe on his truck, thought it was piling, and, you know, and that's where it came from. So that's just kind of a brief explanation of the document. So you have the summary, lots of bridge plans, and then we've just given you a tabulation of all the utility permits, and then the one that caught my eye. But again, at this point, I don't want to try and assert that MnDOT is saying that that is the pipe. We're just saying that that was, you know, a permit that caught our eye. The other thing I'd maybe
On that issue, if that pipe happened to be involved with this permit, as I understood your testimony, was pulled because these pipes needed to be moved because of the road construction. Is that correct?
That's what it looks like to me, Mr. Chairman. That's what I kind of saw. I don't know if we have enough here to draw a complete conclusion, but in order for me to make sure that it was not part of a construction project, that MnDOT wasn't actually doing the work, you'd probably want to double-check with our municipal agreements, folks, and I hadn't had a chance to get in touch with them. We'd have to cross-reference to a different database. I was just looking at the note on the page that said, you know, obviously the utility permit is taken out by the city of Invergrove Heights. It's for an 8-inch sanitary sewer. And then the note that I looked at was work to be coordinated with state's contractor on SB 1985-67, which was one of our projects, under the supervision of Doug MacArthur, who Doug was my AD. Not that you needed to know that, but he was a very sweet guy to work for. And that would at least indicate to me that this was the city doing the work. And that's, you know, that's certainly possible that the city does the work. With private utilities, they almost always do the work. Sometimes our contractors will do municipal relocation, and sometimes the municipalities themselves will do it. So right now, what we have in front of us, it would lead us to believe that it was the city of Invergrove Heights that was working on that 8-inch pipe.
Okay. Mr. Wendeke.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Liegard, would that sewer pipe have been coated in some asbestos material?
Without being able to, you know, investigate it, like I said, I just printed this out, and I'm not an expert on pipe. I would hate to really sit here in front of you and tell you one way or the other. I believe that typically that type of a mastic coating was used as a corrosion protectant. So it would make sense that potentially there could have been, but I don't want to go on record as saying yes or no without maybe being allowed to investigate that piece a little bit more.
Okay. And you were going to go on and explain something else.
Mr. Chairman, the only other thing I was going to say is that I just want to double check when these bridges were worked on. It looks like on my front sheet there, Mark Spafford from our bridge office supplied me with the plans and created this spreadsheet. But it looks to me like the two bridges that we're referencing were tore down in 1980 and 1979. And so I guess maybe the only other thing that kind of jumped out at me was, maybe there are other pipes on the other abutments. I don't know that for sure, but for the two that I was handed, the Concord and then the railroad bridge, it looks to me like, you know, they would have been quite a bit earlier, right at the beginning of when Mr. Schmidt had his landfill open. And so if you think about the way that you'd fill a landfill, it seems like it's unlikely if our stuff was potentially coming in the mid-80s that it would be intertwined with the bridge stuff, because there potentially would have been, you know, 4 or 5 years separating when these pipes would have potentially been dumped and when the and when, you know, other pipe may have been placed there.
Okay. Questions? Senator Hand?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if I have a question. It seems like that what we're disputing is who really was responsible for putting the material, the pipe, on the property, and there may be some debate on that. It seems clear to me, however, that it wasn't the property owners, and what is still mystifying to me is that they're the ones that are on the hook to pay off the balance of the cost to do a removal that, again, they didn't determine what that removal is going to be. It seems as if some department of the state determined how that removal was going to take place, and it was done in a manner that was consistent with the laws and had the costs attendant to it that were eventually incurred. So I don't know what the right motion is, but I think we ought to approve the claim. Maybe there's a way to apportion the payment of it so that it, to whatever degree we don't feel that the Department of Transportation is the culpable body, that maybe there's another place to assess the cost. I don't want to penalize the department, or not penalize them, but have them incur a cost that they're not responsible for. But I don't know that it serves the interests of anyone to have this fester on, and it seems to me that there is some responsibility beyond the property owners here to get this taken care of, and it seems to me that the state has some involvement in that given the conditions that we've determined on how this is to be removed and the cost that will have to be incurred to get it done. So I don't know what the right motion is to do here, but I'd like to at least have us consider paying the claim, and I need some clarification on that too. We had $82,000 here. Maybe it's $67,000 now or whatever the right amount is, but whether it would make sense to try to apportion it among some different entities too.
The Senator Hand, generally the recommendations from the subcommittee goes to the legislature, and the dollars are taken out of the general fund. And the department that we identify is really the one that's responsible for handling that appropriation. But it doesn't really come out of their budget. So the reason why the previous motion was a little different is because we used two separate funds. We actually did use a petrol fund, and otherwise we had the Department of Health administering or paying the dollars back, but it would be out of the general fund. So our recommendation, if it's to make a payment, would be coming out of the general fund. Right. So apportionment really wouldn't complicate things.
Okay, well, then I don't want to do
that.
That
would be my opinion. Mr. Lendeke, am I accurate in that?
Mr. Chairman, could I interject something at this point? From an agency standpoint, I think the only thing I would like to throw out is that depending on how the wording is, my concern for MnDOT would be if we were named on this and it has the words asbestos attached to it and cleanup, we're a huge contracting agency that does a lot of work, and it just seems like we'd have to maybe at least think about ways to insulate ourselves from claims that maybe could look similar to this, but, you know, not be as valid as you're interpreting it. So I would just ask that maybe you give a little thought to that, that from an agency standpoint, I would hate to see us open up exposure to frivolous claims that could look similar in nature.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sympathetic to the McEachrans. I mean, they, unless there was disclosure that they're on top of a construction landfill that took hazardous materials, I mean, they didn't know. But I'm disappointed that we don't have the MPCA here and we don't have in our materials follow-up to the questions that I had raised at the last meeting, because the whole purpose of the state Superfund law was to help people, property owners, clean up a hazardous waste and then sort out the appropriate responsibilities. And I don't think the claims committee is the appropriate place to deal with all the potential brownfields that exist. I can just think of in my district, which has a large industrial past, that this is an appropriate place for us to be mediating that, and particularly when I feel like the city of Inver Grove Heights, which issued the rezoning to make this appropriate for a residential site, I don't know if now in current times you would make a closed construction landfill a residential site. I think we're doing more careful jobs about relating pollution cleanup and landfills to zoning. But, I mean, they're the ones who I think have some responsibility here in having made this a site that maybe should have been done like what we do with most brownfields in my community, which is you clean it up to industrial standards and you say you can't dig below grade and you can't do all these different things. And it just seems to me that the learnings from these kinds of things should be getting brought back into that environmental cleanup loop and not be diverted into the claims committees, whether it was, you know, the Department of Transportation's ultimate things or not. I just don't want to see this committee turn into the Brownfield Resolution Committee, because there's lots of dollars and there's lots of property, and I thought that we had a policy remedy that was actually to try and better weigh these sorts of things in terms of how to allocate the cost between the city and the county and you know, the original responsible parties and everyone else, and to supervise the cleanup to make sure it's done in a responsible way, both in terms of protecting the public and the environment, but also in terms of the cost.
Mr. Lindeke.
Well, Mr. Chair, in answer to Senator Hand's comments and your comments and Mr. Ligard, when we draft the bill, it would presumably be an appropriation of, let's say you propose $67,000 from the general fund to the Department of Transportation to pay the claim by the McEachrans, I'd probably named in the bill, we can avoid any term you like. We can avoid asbestos and cleanup. We can just talk to costs related to their land or something like that. So we can craft it any way we like, and it'll probably, I would guess, if you suggest it, it'll come from the general fund.
Senator Osleen.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak any better than Senator Hand spoke about this, so I guess I would make a motion that we approve this claim at $67,000 out of the general fund.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hand.
And just to, I guess, clarify or modify that, I would want to maybe incorporate in that motion the concerns that Mr. Lindeke just raised and the language that we choose to use in describing it in whatever bill that we don't create potential liabilities for the department. And so just to make that, I guess, for the record, that we would want to make sure that the bill, if this is adopted, would be crafted in such a way as to not create that potential problem.
Mr. Chair, if I...
Motion is before us. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just comfort language so the record is clear. This site predates eligibility for the... It's called Merla in Minnesota. This goes to Representative Loeffler's point. Is apparently the deposits that were made on the property came before and would not be eligible for payment under that fund. That was your question that you raised last time. I apologize. That was supposed to be part of my original presentation to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, the motion before us is to approve the claim for $67,000. from the general fund. Any other questions, comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Claim will be recommended. Now, so everyone's clear on the process, we make recommendations to the full legislature, and it'll be a while before that. They meet in February, and it'll be a while before that this final determination occurs. And follow-up to Representative Loeffler, because I concur with everything that you were saying, and the frustration I've had over the years is that we have not been covering demolition landfills the same way we cover mixed municipal landfills. And yes, the Superfund is there to take over, but when there's no spreading of contamination and that sort of thing that's occurring, and it happens that, as they did, discovered something along the way, Superfund was just not there for them at that time, like it would have been if this had occurred in a mixed municipal landfill. And so we need to really deal with that issue. And Representative Atkins and I have had some extensive discussions about that, that we really do need to set up a fund to help people as these circumstances are discovered, because we know the way that waste material has been disposed of, or at least stored until it's further discovered in future generations, that is just going to create this kind of a problem over and over again, and it could happen in anybody's backyard. And I think as a state we need to start working on that and get us some dollars that would be set aside to deal with these issues and not be pulling people through the knot holes that this particular one did. Everyone pointing fingers, and the property owners really had essentially no active participation in that other than to try and defend their pocketbook.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to work on that as well, because that my area has more brownfields, and I go to more public hearings about groundwater contamination and all kinds of other things than probably most legislators do. And so we'll together try and make sure that we don't turn this into the Brownfields Remediation Committee and actually have more learned minds than ours from the scientific community and elsewhere guiding the process.
And I want to thank the department very much for being getting us the information and helping us try to sort this out as much as possible. Like you say, we don't have really a smoking gun that, so to speak, we can point a finger at, but it looks like almost all guns indicate the state's involvement at some point, so this will be a general fund responsibility.
Thanks.
We have, did Mr. Hartnick, do you have all his issues taken care of?
I think so.
Oh, you're welcome. See you later. Bye, John.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah. It's been a long trip.
You're very welcome. Now, you know this is not final. You still got further road to go. Okay. Yeah. Senator Latz around? I think we're ready, if we are going to be ready. What we've been, some questions were raised this morning with regard to the proposal that Senator Latz outlined, and some of that has been getting researched as we have been handling some of our other business. And I assume Senator Latz wants a few more minutes? Sure.
Take a 5-minute recess.
I might as well get up and walk around for 5 minutes.
You can get up. We'll have a temporary recess to the college chair. Don't go very far.
Okay.
It's very frustrating. That's what we did with mixed municipal solid waste. We had Superfund handling. And that went after the But then they turned on and started seeing everyone on the pop-up. So then we stepped in as a state and said, wait a minute.